Welcome back, folks. Thank you for joining us here in the second segment for our members. We're talking with E. Michael Jones about many things pertaining to his work over at culturewars.com. I wanted to kind of pick up a little bit where we left off there and talk a little bit more from the angle of the relations between Jews and Catholics, and if there's been a long-standing struggle between these groups. I mean, I've always questioned if there's been some kind of resistance, just as you mentioned before, but from the Roman Catholic perspective, if there's been animosity between these groups, and why it is that we've seen such a relentless attack on the Catholic institution in the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years. What, I mean, how do you view this with all the new popes coming in and the new way that they are kind of reforming the church? There's, I know I'm bringing up a lot here right now, but, you know, they've even brought in like aliens into it and things like that. They've really tried to, I don't know, cater to a larger audience, I guess. How do you view all this as a Catholic, Michael?
Well, I mean, I was confronted by this, I guess, around the year, right around the beginning of this century, this decade. The church had gone out of its way to accommodate the Jews as a result of the Second Vatican Council. They just went out of their way to have friendly relations with the Jews. There was Catholic-Jewish dialogue, on and on and on. And then suddenly you have a man like Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, who's got this professorship at Harvard, writes a book that was a totally fraudulent piece of work. I mean, he's talking about Pius XII as somehow responsible for the persecution that the Jews had experienced during World War II. And I'm reading these quotes, you know, and he made it up. I mean, what did he think that, you know, the Goyim don't know how to speak Italian or read Italian, you know, where he's changing words, putting words in the mouth of the Pope after the confrontation in the Wittelsbacher Palace, you know, and so on and so forth. So I just began to think, what's going on here? There's something bigger here than just you expect according to ordinary interpersonal dynamics. There's something really wrong with this picture. And I decided to go back and start thinking things through. And I went back to the beginning, which is, or what I consider the beginning, which is basically the center point of human history, which is when Jesus Christ became a man and started walking this earth. He was the Messiah that the Jews had expected. And when he came, the Jews had to either accept the Messiah or reject him. And the Jews who accepted the Messiah became known as Christians or Catholics, and the succession was the Catholic Church. The children of Moses were the people who accepted Jesus Christ. And the Jews who rejected him, well, what did they become? And I realized when you reject Jesus Christ, it's not just some guy. This is the Logos incarnate. Logos is the Greek word for word. It gets translated as word in English, which is a bad translation. I don't know anything better. We just don't have a word for Logos. It's the order of the universe. The beginning of St. John's Gospel is en arche en ha logos. In the beginning, there was this order of reason. This is the mind of God. And so when you reject Jesus Christ, you're rejecting the order of the universe. And when you reject the order of the universe, you become a revolutionary. And that's precisely what the Jews did. They solemnly called for Jesus Christ's death, and they solemnly chose Barabbas in his stead, and Barabbas was a revolutionary. And they've been rejecting the Logos ever since. And so, naturally, you're going to have a conflict between the church that represents the Logos and the revolutionaries who are determined to overthrow Logos in human affairs. There's no way of getting around this. And the conflict immediately came to the fore in the Acts of the Apostles, where the Jews are persecuting Christians. And then we had the revolutionary fulfillment with the rebellion against Rome that led to the destruction of the temple, and then another rebellion when Simon Bar Kokhba led to the defeat by the Romans and then the dispersal of the Jews throughout the world, mm-hmm. the known world.
Yeah.
That conflict is not going to go away.
Right.
That's the whole point. There was this kind of naivete in the 1960s where we were all going to kiss and make up and the lion was going to lie down with the lamb. Well, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. The church bent over backwards to accommodate every what they felt were the legitimate claims of the Jews, and the Jews did nothing but escalate their claims to the point where Daniel Jonah Goldhagen would say, well, the only way we will accept your sincerity in reforming is if you throw out the gospel, you're not allowed to preach the gospel of St. John anymore, it's anti-Semitic, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is totally impossible. Sorry, but it's impossible. And on top of that, you're an intellectual fraud. Everybody knows you're a fraud now. You know, you've been exposed as a fraud. And so what you see here is warfare, cultural warfare that has gone on for two millennia. And the only the church has been crippled now. Catholic Church has been crippled in response to the Jews because they can't believe that the Jews are their enemies. Well, we have enemies, and the Jews are enemies of the entire human race, according to St. Paul. So they're certainly going to be enemies of the Catholic Church. And as a Christian, you're supposed to love your enemies, but you're not supposed to pretend you don't have any. And that's what has led to the catastrophic situation we're in right now. I've already talked about the Legion of Decency. You know, the collapse of that was basically because of this irenic tone that came out of Vatican II, and they let the Jews break the production code and promote pornography and destroy their culture. Well, that's not a productive way to be. So what I'm urging, after all, like 2,000 years of revolutionary movements, I go into detail about all of them. It's a long book. I'm urging that the church return to its tradition. Namely, the policy that they had toward the Jews at the beginning, when they first realized they needed a policy toward the Jews, which is to say around the 6th century, around the time of St. Leo the Great. Anyway, it's called Sicut Iudaeus Non. It's two parts. It is reiterated by every pope for 1,000 years, probably even more than that. If you take Cardinal Hlon's statement on anti-Semitism on the Jews in Poland in 1930, it was basically 1,900 years of the same principle. Principle is very clear. On the one hand, no one has a right to harm the Jew. No one has a right to disturb his religious services. No one has a right to desecrate his cemeteries and so on and so forth. On the other hand, the Jew has no right to undermine the morals of a Christian country or subvert the faith of the Christians that he comes in contact with. Now, you put those two things together, and I think what you have is basically a viable modus operandi that can allow both Jews of goodwill and Catholics to live in the same culture. If you if you persist in believing these myths that come out of the Enlightenment, like Nathan der Weise by Lessing's play about the ring and all this other type of stuff, it's going to lead to a violent reaction. That's what happened in the 1930s. It's going to happen again. I have Jewish friends who are telling me that the 30s is going to look like a walk in the park compared to what's coming, you know. And they want the restoration of this Catholic principle because they think it's the most sensible way to protect themselves.
Hmm. So, saying there's obviously a long-standing animosity between these groups, they're based in, you know, cultural, you know, ideas, religious, of course, and you view this as a war, which is a perspective that I think many people do not have about this. They don't see it on that broader kind of scale, if you will. But the fact is then that the Catholic Church has been in a, as far as I see it, a kind of a defensive position for a very long time. We have, of course, all the sexual scandals that have occurred. We can certainly go into that a little bit, but there seems to be a willing tendency, of course, within the mainstream media out there to highlight this over the top in the media, like we haven't seen with other things. Certain scandals are just really bloomed out. And so what are some of the responses to some of this? Does the Catholic Church not have means and resources anymore? I mean, people are talking about how influential the Jesuits used to be, the various orders within the church, etc. What is happening there now?
Well, nothing is happening in this regard. That's the problem. Because no one is willing to face up to the problem. So there was a crisis at the time of the Ratzinger papacy where he resigned. A new guy comes in. This new guy is like the antithesis. Pope Francis is the antithesis of the German professor. He's a guy who is, impulsive. So one of his, you know, his gestures are often very striking. So, for example, when he was in Israel, he got out of the Pope Mobile and went over to the apartheid wall. This is the wall hemming in the Palestinians. And put his hand up and prayed at that wall. Did you see this image?
No, I didn't actually. No.
Yeah, this is really significant that you didn't see this image because it was really suppressed. I mean, it was in none of the accounts of the Pope Francis's visit. And so he prayed, and Netanyahu was absolutely furious at this because it's the anti-icon to Pope John Paul II praying at the Wailing Wall. It's a recognition that there is a problem in Israel, you know, and the problem is with the way they treat the Palestinians, and the problem goes to the heart of the Israeli state. But in terms of conscious program, no, there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing, because the Jews are supposed to be considered our elder brothers, and we're not allowed to criticize them. And if you're not allowed to criticize them, you know, you're condemning yourself to just be totally stultified. I mean, basically, we're Catholics. We live in America. We live in a totally Jewish culture, because it's dominated by Hollywood, by the news media, who just tell us what to think. And anytime you try and raise your voice and criticize them, you're called an anti-Semite.
Sure, yeah.
Well, I mean, since when does criticizing Jews qualify as anti-Semitism? Does that mean Moses was an anti-Semite? He criticized Jews. And so what you have here is the creation of this kind of monstrous double standard right now when it comes to the sexual scandals, for example. So to give you a recent example, X-Men is probably in theaters now. It's all over the world, probably in Sweden as well. And basically, this is just Jewish propaganda. All comic book movies are Jewish propaganda, because all comic books are Jewish propaganda. Superman, Batman, now X-Men, okay? But it's okay. That's one thing, okay? And if you say that, as I said, I'm stating the obvious. A Jew can say this. I can't say it. If mm-hmm. I say it, I'm an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
Look at this guy, Bryan Singer. He's the director of X-Men. Well, he's been accused of pedophilia by people who say he had sex with me, you know, one guy after another. And for some reason, the only time the charges of pedophilia get any traction is when they're made against a Catholic priest.
Yeah.
So you got this colossal double standard. What about Woody Allen? His stepdaughter says he had sex with me, and Woody Allen should just dismiss it. If you're a Jewish director in Hollywood, you're above the law. Let's face it. You're innocent until proven guilty. If you're a Catholic priest, you're guilty until proven innocent. Well, I'm not the only guy who has noticed this. And I'm saying this is leading to a kind of resentment that is going to be, it's going to get worse and worse until someone can articulate a way of dealing with it. And that's what I tried to do with the book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit.
Yeah, it's like Corey Haim. He later killed himself, of course.
And his We're talking about he committed suicide.
Yeah.
Corey Feldman says pedophilia is the biggest problem in Hollywood, and they all get ignored.
Yeah, exactly. He wrote the book on it and mentioned all these powerful, producers and people within the industry and everything else. And so, exactly. And that's all, you know, we're trying to highlight here and bring attention to that. The contradictions, the double standards, the way that it applies to some but not to others and everything. And so there's obviously a huge, you know, cover-ups and issues of this here. I mean, did you ever see Hollywoodism, the documentary? Was a similar book written by, what's his name again? Nagler or something like that. I forget his name now, but that talked a little bit about the creation of the what they dubbed the American dream, that they were basically, you know, manufacturing the culture and everything else. Did you ever get a chance to see that one?
Yeah, I have read that book. Yeah. It's a dream of their own. So he says the subtitle of the book is How Jews Created Hollywood. So then this Englishman writes an article and says Jews control Hollywood. And this guy calls him an anti-Semite for saying exactly the same thing he said. I mean, this is intolerable. We have reached an intolerable situation where there are organizations out there who are going to try and destroy me for saying what is obvious, and anytime you exercise criticism of this, you're going to be demonized as an anti-Semite. This is intolerable. The world has had enough of this.
Yeah, and I mean, LA Times, you have the same there. Joel Stein openly discusses it. Actually, he gets even into a debate with Abe Foxman out of the ADL there, because he tries to claim that he's reinforcing a stereotype or whatever, but as like, is it, if it's true, it's true. What are you going to do about it? You know, if they are prominent of owning the industry and the production houses in Hollywood, then isn't it so? Since when did we just begin to deny reality for the fact that it might hurt someone's feelings, you know?
Well, that's been the situation here for a long time. I mean, I'll give you another example. Joe Biden, our vice president, our illustrious vice president, gave a speech to a Jewish organization in which he said Jews are responsible for gay marriage. Now, he said that because he thought gay marriage was a good thing. And then he said they were behind the civil rights movement, blah, 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 the whole thing. Now, if I were to say Jews were behind gay marriage, I would be called an anti-Semite. Mm. So, I mean, let's get it straight here. You have exactly the same statement, and it's okay for some like Joe Biden to say it because he thinks it's a good thing, but it's bad for me to say it because I think it's a bad thing.
Right.
This makes no sense. We can't. This is not discourse, according to Logos. You know,
I think you're right, though, as well, because I think that this is something that's going to kind of it's going to fail tremendously in the long run, because the more people, of course, are being denied or being asked rather to deny reality, this is something that inherently is going to be instinctively resisted within people. So, I mean, you paint the flip side picture here that this is actually a very bad thing, because this will lead to a lot of strife, a lot of conflict, a lot of pain and hurt and violence even potentially. And of course we want to try to avoid that. So, I mean,
that's exactly right. We want to avoid the violent reaction that took place during the 1930s, which was the violent reaction against its decadence that the Jews imposed on German culture during the 1920s. People like Magnus Hirschfeld, the Weimar Republic, the cabaret syndrome, the whole thing, you know, we want to avoid that. And the only way we avoid it is by doing making use of reason, and also I'm saying by situating this question in a religious context, in the particularly Catholic context, and talk about the Catholic experience of dealing with Jewish subversion for over a millennium, namely secret Judaeus non, the principle I just described.
There's another side to this as well I wanted to ask you a little bit more about. It has to do with Europe specifically, but also America in terms of immigration, for example. There's we have people in Sweden, like Barbara Spector. She's Jewish. She's behind the organization PIDEA, Jewish Learning Center or Jewish Studies, I think, that it's taxpayer-funded. And she recently made fame because, of course, she talked about how the Jews were going to be responsible for basically making Europe multicultural and bringing in a lot of immigrants into the country. And it was specifically kind of focused on Sweden as well. And I've seen this come up time and time again, actually. We just published a recent article about how Israel is actually shipping out African illegal immigrants that have arrived at Israel's border to Sweden. They're actually even paying them $3,500, I think it was, per person to leave.
Sure.
And to go up to Sweden. What is this all about? And why are these organizations behind, not only, of course, inadvertently, then the Islamification of Europe, but there's, of course, a lot of other immigrants as well that are pouring into. What is all this about? Why are they doing this?
Well, the Jews are always a minority. They're always going to be a minority in any culture. They're always a revolutionary minority. They always feel uncomfortable. They always feel that they have to overthrow the social order. They always feel that they're going to be persecuted. They have this persecution complex. And so they feel that the best way to deal with this is to weaken whatever the majority is. And so in the United States, the majority was basically Northern European. And so in 1965, Senator Jacob Javits, a Jewish senator from New York State, passed an immigration bill that promoted the immigration from non-European countries as a way of weakening the majority and creating so that there's no kind of ethnic solidarity among the people of the nation. Now, you can say, okay, the United States never had ethnic solidarity in the way that the Swedes or the French or whoever had it. I mean, it was a propositional nation from the beginning. But what was there was totally undermined. You found the same thing in France. The Jews were behind the massive immigration of Muslims from North Africa, again, to weaken the majority, because they only feel comfortable when the majority is weakened. And so what you have here is basically organizations like the ADL. You know, you're on the subway, and there's the ADL poster where there's a black child and a yellow child and a white child and a red child. And they all have their arms around them, each other, saying multiculturalism is great. Well, I mean, Kevin McDonald has pointed out they promote multiculturalism for every group but the Jews. And they promote the opposite among the Jews. It's basically strict ethnic solidarity, a rigorous control of the Jewish population, in a mobilization of the Jewish population according to basically racial principles. That's what we're talking about here. Israel's the last racial state left in the world. And I think that explains this kind of simultaneous promotion of two basically contradictory policies.
Well, exactly. There's two points here I want to address. One is, of course, another story we had published here, how the Israeli government actually funded a multi-billion dollar worldwide campaign to actually stop Jews from mixing with other non-Jews. Now, we'll link to the story so you guys can read it and see what you think about that for yourself. But they've invested a lot of money in these campaigns. There have been sporadic kind of tests like this back and forth in terms of one of the models there, Bara Failure, whatever. She was dating, what's his name again, the movie star there, DiCaprio, for a while. And it was like these letters sent to her that, please, you know, do not marry this guy and stuff like that. But nonetheless, it's one of those aspects. So there's a double standard there. We can understand that. But on the flip side to this as well, recently, to look at the other side of it, Pope Francis recently said that Europe needs to bring in more immigrants as well. So is he on the same page as they are now on this issue?
Well, he's a mixed bag. I mean, I have to say. I mean, he's impulsive, and his impulses are right most of the time. But I think he's totally naive when it comes to understanding the Jews and the role that the Jews have played in the subversion of Christian cultures throughout Europe. I think he's totally naive. And I don't understand this blind spot, but I think he's naive in understanding the way they work.
And there's another thing I want to mention as well, and maybe we can talk more about that. There's a lot of studies that have been done because people have a notion and a concept, a media version of what has been sold to them of a rainbow nation of diversity, peace, love, and understanding and happiness and everything. But as it turns out, and I've been reading a lot of these studies lately, is that diversity leads to a lot of ethnic problems and conflicts. For example, an obvious example is what we saw in Sweden last year with the riots in the Stockholm suburbs and everything else. And this has been going for a while in many of the other European countries as well. But the fact is, from the Swedish perspective, sure, there was a couple down in Malmö, also a very big, large immigrant population there some years prior to this. But we've never seen anything like that in Sweden before, basically. I mean, we have to go back to 400 or 500 years,
So why would Africans end up in Sweden? That's ridiculous. I mean, unless they were put there for a particular reason. I think this is going to lead to a violent reaction. I think the Breivik case in Norway is an example of what we're talking about here.
Right. It's a lash
and
out.
And I think he was instrumentalized. I think he was used by certain, MI5, MI6, the CIA, the Jewish organizations. I think he was used. But the thing that got him going was basically the excessive immigration, the destruction of ethnic Norwegian culture. I think that's what got him started down that road.
Well, of course, exactly. And just the prime incentive here, that it's actually about causing conflict and chaos. I mean, it's completely contradictory to what we've been told. What is going to lead to, and a lot of people are still having difficulty realizing this and understanding this. But the fact is that I've always tried to push towards this, that it's by design. They want to have as much conflict and instability as possible in the most, what used to be in some of the most peaceful nations. I mean, this will give incentive not only for the control apparatus to come in and more surveillance and militarization of the police and everything else, but it will really give a conflict kind of oriented environment where a lot of people will be fearful. They will kind of actually separate people, which is a very interesting kind of aspect. But it's a tactic. That's my point. It's by design. Yeah,
I think it is by design. I think you're absolutely right. And the paradigm that I'm trying to propose, for example, when I was in Poland, is Catholic nationalism, which is in many ways an oxymoron. But I think that's what Europe was. I think that was the creation of Europe. You basically had all of these, my ancestors, the warring, the Germanic tribes, who loved chasing pigs through the forest and were just barbarians, They were settled, they were taught how to farm by the Benedictines, who created monasteries up and down the Danube and vineyards and orchards, and they became civilized. They didn't stop being Germans or whatever they were. It was not multiculturalism, but they did have this unifying bond of Christianity that allowed these various ethnic groups to get together. That's the goal. In Poland, I think what you have here, at least recently, was a kind of incoherent nationalist reaction. So, for example, the Jews and their lackeys created these rainbows, over the public squares in Warsaw, and the nationalists showed up and they burned the rainbows down. Okay, I'm great. I think you should burn the rainbow down. And then they go, and then they attack the Russian embassy. Well, there's a kind of incoherence here, because at this very moment, what you saw was a convergence between Poland and Russia on gender issues. You know, this is precisely the moment that the Polish bishops are issuing their statement on gender ideology. The Russians are, you know, they're having their, they're banning the promotion of homosexuality. They're limiting abortion. You had this moment of convergence that I think simple nationalism, reactive nationalism, is not going to understand and will lose its opportunity. Because in effect, that's what happened in the 30s. You had this kind of reactive pagan nationalism that basically increased the power of the Jews. That's the net result of it.
But, I mean, the SS, though, I mean, they were baptized in, you know, Catholic ceremonies and everything else. They were very much actually returning. I mean, look at the rat lines, for example, the cooperation between the Catholic Church and the National Socialist, right? So how do we explain that?
There's one simple explanation. It's called the Anti-Communist Crusade. The rat lines took place after the fall of after the Second World War. The people in Croatia and places like that were scared to death of the communists, and so the church collaborated with the West in the anti-communist crusade. That's what the rat lines were about, you know. And I think that was a mistake. I think it was. I think even John Paul II was weakened by his by the culmination of the anti-communist crusade, and I think he regretted it at the end of his life. You know?
I think one thing as well that people don't understand is that, and this always comes up, of course, but the preamble to, you know, the Second World War, actually long before that, really. I mean, we of course can talk about the First World War and all the, you know, sanctions that was put on Germany and the Versailles Treaty and, you know, all these things, nastiness that was going on against Germany in that regard. It was like ample and ramped up to it. But the fact is that the way that the country was just completely torn apart by the, you know, the left and the right in that regard, and the way that there was a complete chaos, there were a lot of bloodshed and things like that, and it was like, it's almost like I'm seeing a similar kind of build up today, that the polarization is so extreme that it's difficult to see that there's like another, you know, how can this not be resolved in a violent way? I hate to see it that way, but I don't know how to put it another way. If these sides that we're looking at now, left and right, are, call them whatever you want, there's fact is they're extremely polarized. How will this play out, do you think? What's going to happen here with all of this?
You're right. The main danger is going to be this violent nationalist reaction. And I think that's what we saw in the Ukraine. It's a very paradoxical situation in the Ukraine where the United States is supporting basically neo-Nazi thugs, where the Jews and the Nazis are in bed together. I mean, it's like Hegelian. It's dialectic, you know.
Yeah.
But they are instrumentalizing this nationalist reaction that they themselves created. I mean, let's face it. It was a Jew that created this animosity in the first place. We're talking about Lazar Kaganovich and the starvation of millions of people in the Ukraine that led to these Ukrainian SS divisions, right? And now all of that is being channeled against Russia when Russia isn't communist anymore. You know?
Well, exactly. It's a good point. I think people misses that. The reason also why Bandera and all these people, you know, band up is like why this was created at that time is because the threat of communism was larger to them than it was in terms of National Socialism. They saw an ally there to break free from it, you know? So
absolutely. That's why they formed the Ukrainian SS division.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, our point is to appeal to Logos at this point and try and avert this violent nationalist reaction that's looming on the horizon, that seems inevitable. I mean, we have to believe that there has to be a peaceful alternative to this. And the point is, it's only by bringing this question out in the open right now. Let's talk openly about these things, and let's not suppress the thing, because the more we suppress the discussion, the more we're adding fuel to the violent nationalist reaction.
Yeah, that has always kind of been my take on it too. It's like just for the sake of highlighting something which is seldomly talked about is just so important at these times, because there's so much suppression, so much you know, denial of discussion going on, that this stuff has to be vented. Otherwise, it'll be turning it will blow like a powder keg eventually. You know,
I think you're absolutely right.
So yeah, there's a lot to this, of course. Now, why don't we talk a little bit more here about what you think in terms of the situation in Ukraine then? How do you see that this is going to play out now? Where I haven't been following the story too much the last couple of weeks here, the developments here, but is there going to be any resolution to the situation? Is this something that's going to spread, do you think, to other European countries?
Well, I think that what we're going to see in Germany is a large group of people who are starting to realize that it's not in their interest to support the United States anymore, and it is in their interest to support Russia, simply for purely financial reasons. That, you know, Angela Merkel threatening Putin with economic sanctions is like Angela Merkel putting a gun to her own head and threatening to pull the trigger. You know, Germany is totally dependent upon Russian gas and Russian oil. And I think that the net result of the latest 10, 20 years of American politics is to totally alienate the Europeans from their identification with America. Everybody feels that Americans are hypocrites, that they make rules and they don't follow them, and so on and so forth. And what we're seeing here is basically the final chapter in an over 100-year story of basically the Mackinder thesis. Halford Mackinder was an English professor who said that you had to control the Eurasian, the island nations, England and the United States, had to control the pivot of civilization, which was the Eurasian landmass. And so Victoria Nuland's coup was a last attempt. It was an attempt to do exactly that, and it failed. And I think that now you're seeing a resurgent Russia. The philosopher Dugin, who is basically the thinker behind Vladimir Putin, is now gaining currency among people in Middle Europe, you know, the Germans, for example. I just read an article today about one of these guys talking this way. I think that there'll be a moment of opportunity, but it's only going to be fulfilled if it takes place within the purview of logos, which is kind of what I started talking about today, which is reason, which is practical reason. The economy has to be brought back into the realm of practical reason. We have to get rid of capitalism. Capitalism had its day. The American empire had its day. The Anglo-American attempt to control the Eurasian landmass. They've all had their day. And so I feel my goal is to help the church, the Catholic Church, disconnect from its association with the American empire. The anti-communist crusade had a catastrophic effect on American Catholicism and world Catholicism. I think that Pope Benedict was an example of this. He was a German who had been socially engineered after the war to think that there was something special about America. There's nothing special about America. It should go back to just being a republic and just taking care of places like Indiana, where I live, which are being looted to fund this war of empire. You know, we need to withdraw from that and to try and work within our power, do what we can to collaborate with people of goodwill to bring about a peaceful resolution at this, what I think is a crucial turning point in history. We're living through it right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
The end of the American empire happened in the Ukraine, when Crimea went back to Russia. And now there are people in the United States, I'm sure, who are trying to lure Russia into a nuclear war in the Ukraine to finish off the job, this kind of total Götterdämmerung type of thinking, you know, where we're going to succeed out Kaiser, out Nihil, as the Romans used to say. Either I'm going to become emperor or I'm going to destroy everything. We have to really work and pray that reasonable people throughout the world will prevail, and that this hegemony of the Jewish revolutionary spirit will simply go into remission, work for the conversion of the Jews, and a return to a more rational policy for the world.
I wanted to ask you a bit more about usury, the control or production, I guess, at this stage of money, fiat money, and also you mentioned capitalism, that this is, you know, not compatible with the Catholic Church. Now, do you equate capitalism with free market, or do you make a distinction there?
No, I'm not a socialist. I believe that you have to have a market in order to have a price. I believe that basically what needs to be resurrected is the German tradition of economics that began with the collapse of the Roman Empire. The as I said before, the Benedictines brought Christianity to Germany, and the thing that got created, the implementation of that, was called the Holy Roman Empire. Just this, all these little principalities, that the only thing they had in common was trying to implement Christianity in some type of coherent basis. And the main thing that in which they differed, which in which the Benedictines differed from the Roman Empire that they succeeded, was their attitude toward labor on the one hand and usury on the other. The Roman Empire was shot through with usury, and it held labor in contempt. When Christianity took over Europe, it reversed those poles. It banned usury, it made usury illegal, and it made labor, it sanctified labor. And so the motto of the Benedictines was ora et labora, pray and work. And the Germans, to this day, I have to say, to their credit, have retained a sense of valuing human labor that you can't find anywhere in the Anglo, in the English-speaking world, mm-hmm. which is the main vehicle of capitalism. And so I've written a history of capitalism. It's called Barren Metal, a long book, and it will be out in September. And in many ways, it's the sequel to The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, because it talks about Jewish finance, the Jewish involvement in usury. But it's also the story of the rise of German economics, beginning at that time, with the resurrection of thought, with the rehabilitation of thought that Kant brought about by the creation of the synthetic a priori, and Fichte operating on that principle and coming up with a kind of utopian idea of what the economy was, and then the Germans working step by step to create an alternative to this rapacious English capitalism that was destroying the entire world. You know, that's what that book is about, and that's my hope, that the Germans can wake up. I mean, I hope it's not too late, you know, get over their dreams of sexual liberation, which are nothing but a form of control, and return to the Catholic roots of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, and their understanding that labor is the source of all value, and that usury needs to be banned. That's basically my hope.
With all things considered and what we've gone through, cycle, et cetera, are you hopeful? Do you even think it a possibility that people, you know, if we look at Europe first, I guess, would even have an inclination of trying to return to Catholicism in any capacity? Is that a realistic?
Yes, I think that it's inevitable they have to return to Catholicism, or they're going to go out of existence. The Protestantism has shown itself as just bankrupt. It was basically a looting operation to begin with. That's what it was in England. That's what it was in Scandinavia. That's what it was in Germany. That's what it was in Scotland. The princes wanted the loot, and the horny priest wanted sexual liberation. And that, between the two of them, that was the Protestant Reformation. So there's got to be a return to the principle of European unity, which is the Catholic Church. It's got to happen. If it doesn't, we are just going to Europe will cease to exist. So as to being hopeful, our hope is in the Lord. And as I said before, I mean, everything was pretty much programmed by social engineering, covert ops, and then suddenly 1979 happened. And so I'm just hoping that the spirit of 1979 will revive and we'll be understand where the true enemies, who our enemies are, and where we need to go to create a better society.
We kind of alluded to this a little bit before, but I wanted to ask you, how do you see Islam as a player in this, specifically on the European scene here now then, because we've linked to a couple of videos where we have people openly talking within the Islamic world of, you know, they're letting us into Europe, our birth rates is outnumbering theirs, we'll literally control Europe in 2040 or something like that, you know. Is that a realistic view that they're presenting there?
Yes, it's realistic. Islam is the scourge of God. I said this in Iran, I'm saying it here now, that's what it is. Whenever the church, whenever Christian Europe loses its way, Islam marches in and takes over to fill the vacuum, because God abhors a vacuum. Like nature, God abhors a vacuum, especially a moral vacuum. And so when it comes to a choice between living in England according to the gospel of Sid Vicious and the Sex Pistols, or living according to Islamic law, the people are going to choose Islam. It's inevitable because Islam will restore order in a way that this sexualized culture cannot. And so what you're seeing is mass conversions. I said I was in Iran 2 weeks ago. I spoke to the Basiji, which are like the auxiliary of the Revolutionary Guard. They're the people that wear those green headbands with Islamic writing, and they march in parades, and they scare the hell out of Americans when they see them. And I was talking about the birth control crisis in Iran. And there's a woman sitting next to me. It's Yvonne Ridley, an English journalist who was captured by the Taliban and became a Muslim. So she's there sitting next to me dressed in her chadar. And I'm going on a birth control, and she interrupts me. And she starts talking about women deserve the right to choose. So I think that what you saw there was a kind of, in many ways, a superficial conversion. I don't think that's the identity of the English. I think the true identity of the English is that they're Catholic, way deep down inside. I think that was the appeal of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. It had this nostalgia for the Catholic England.
Really?
I think that's what it was about.
Interpretation of it, yeah. All right.
The hobbits are the Catholic Englishmen. I mean, he didn't say that, but I mean, it's obviously a work of fiction. But these are the rural people who preserve the old religion.
Well, think about it, though. They're going to a mountain, Mount Zion. They're kind of smaller. They're into gold and money. I thought it was always an analogy of Jews, you know.
the hobbit is you're absolutely right.
The dwarves, I'm saying.
That whole speech that Bilbo gives in was made up by Peter Jackson about, you know, you people don't have a homeland, I'll help you. And there's Mount Zion in the background.
Yeah.
You know? You're right. It was Zionist propaganda.
Just to clarify that, I said hobbits, and that's wrong. I mean the dwarves in the story, in The Hobbit.
The dwarves are Jews. There's no question about that. And what you saw in The Hobbit and in The Lord of the Rings is Tolkien's ambivalent attitude toward the Jews. That's precisely what comes out. This attitude toward the hobbits is totally unambivalent. They are the heroes and so on and so forth. But he can't quite overcome his ambivalence to the Jews. And I think that that's part of the incoherence. I just wrote a piece on that in Culture Wars, in the May issue of Culture Wars. We can send anybody a copy. We can send it by PDF. So all you have to do is contact me by email at jones@culturewars.com. And I'll send you my take on why Tolkien screwed up Wagner's imagery. You know, I think you're right. The dwarves are Jews. Everybody knows that, you know. And it was his ambivalent relationship toward the Jews and toward Wagner that basically made The Lord of the Rings incoherent. But that doesn't change the fact that the hobbits are the old England, you know. And that's the nostalgia that just haunts Lord of the Rings.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I have a completely different interpretation. But it's, and pre-Christian tradition overall. But I really appreciate the... you know, the input. It's very interesting hearing about this, Michael. It's very fascinating. And of course, you've done a lot of research on the relation specifically between, you know, the Catholic Church and the Jewish people and everything else. And just another note, I was thinking about this too while we were talking a little bit more about the Islamification of Europe and everything. And you said that people have a tendency to kind of attract to a stronger force, whether they admit that or not, which is very interesting. I've seen this myself in terms of, for example, the feminists in Sweden. They hate the Swedish men that could be there to protect them, for example, but they express love and complete admiration for example, you know, the hijab or the burqa and stuff like that. And they're like, they love the Muslims where they come in and everything. So it's a very interesting dynamic to see how these completely contradictory, seemingly contradictory political ideologies and religious ideologies are kind of clashing and merging. And I think that the people of Europe has to kind of really watch their back on this too, because a lot of people, just as you said, will be actually drawn to it because of the fierceness of it, and that's ultimately what people, if it's been loose for a while, they want something that is more, you know, stronger and traditional and kind of, you know, tighten the belt a bit, and then that might wax and wane, I guess, as well. But yeah, it's a real danger there, you know. It is.
Yeah, I agree. The polls asked me the same question when I was on my book tour over there, and I said, well, look at the countries. Which countries in Europe are in danger, most in danger of Islamification? Well, they're the most sexually decadent countries, right? Like England and Germany, for example. Poland is not a big, it's not a big threat in Poland, but it is a big threat in England and Germany because they are the most sexually decadent. And after a while, you realize you can't live according to those principles. You need some type of totalitarian force to take control of your life and tell you what to do, because you messed up your life by following this other plan, and you're not going to do that again. I think that's what's happening. And in many ways, it is an alien imposition in Europe. I don't think it's going to work. That's why I brought up the example of the lady in at the Basiji in Tehran.
Yeah, exactly.
It's an alien imposition. So I said, Islam is not the problem. The problem is the vacuum, the moral vacuum that the absence of faith has created in Europe. If that ended, Islam wouldn't be a problem anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's happened before, you know, Gates of Vienna, it's, you know, there's been a lot
Whenever Christendom's weak, Islam is the force that is the scourge of God. And it comes in and imposes a draconian order on the decadent Christians.
I think we're in for an interesting ride here in the next 10, 20 years or so, maybe even sooner. We'll see how this develops. But in the meantime, Michael, we say thank you for coming on the program and sharing some of your work with us, some of the things you've been researching over the years. Please give us the website again, and if there's any other additional titles that you want to mention. You have a lot of books there, so please go ahead. If people are new to your work, where do you suggest that they begin?
Yeah, go to culturewars.com, and you can check out all of the books. Or, as I said before, if you send me an email at jones@culturewars.com, I'll send you the May issue of Culture Wars, and you can read the story of Tolkien and Wagner. And that may be join in the conversation that's been going on at Culture Wars magazine every month.
All right, very good. CultureWars.com, and of course, the email address, and jones@culturewars.com. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Keep up the good work, and I hope we can touch base again in the future and see where this goes, okay?
Thank you very much.
And that's our program for today, ladies and gentlemen. As you might know, I have a completely different view on our pre-Christian traditions and European so-called paganism or heathenism, and I do consider the ancient, beautiful traditions that we have in Europe our way towards balance. It is an interesting fact, though, that the pagan tradition was something that was brought right into the formulation of the Catholic system. This means, then, that the components within the faith has a strong root in a more ancient tradition, whether this is recognized or not. So the claim that Catholicism is our salvation makes for an interesting take then, considering the relationship. Personally, I'm not against anyone, and I think that anyone that is encouraging a system that is about the preservation of our beautiful diversity that we have on this planet and mutual respect is something I would support anywhere, the Christian faith included and everybody else. I think that Ásatrú, the Celtic and Slavic mythology and tradition, is something that we need to return to within Europe if we are to survive. Our lack of veneration for the natural order, the order in nature, and the disillusionment with the very dead system that we find ourselves trapped within is the very reason why we keep getting weakened and challenged in the way that we do. We need a strong rooting in our ancestry and our lands. We've done a lot of shows on this now, and I recommend that you listen to all of them and learn more and do everything you can to awaken the warrior in you and the one that stands in veneration of the beauty in this world. Everything that made you, you. We'll be back next with Stephen McNallan on this very topic of metagenetics and ancestry. Don't miss it. After this, we have Kyle Hunt. I hope you have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much for listening and for your support as a member. Thank you. We will talk more soon. Have a good one.